Save big money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get your project started right with our huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, from installing a walkway to setting a post. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
I spent $40,000 on shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Coral, the Sphinx.
Can't you buy our whole dress?
Coral, the Sphinx.
Great gowns.
Coral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit Podcast.
So much to discuss today.
Yes, we finally saw Backrooms and Obsession. We are the last two podcasters probably to be discussing these movies. But before we get into the episode, I think we need to discuss what happened at the AMC when we saw these movies.
Yeah, we need to debrief because I have a bit of trauma, I have to say.
I feel like, honestly, this is all my fault, so I owe you an apology.
It's not your fault, although you were in charge of scheduling.
I am solo parenting this week. I only bring this up to say that Chelsea and Tatiana graciously accommodated my childcare schedule, which meant that we had to see Obsession at 10:20 in the morning and Backrooms at 1 p.m.
Such intuitive times to watch horror movies.
You would think that the problem would have happened at the 10:20 screening of Obsession. But that screening was chill.
Extremely chill. And sparsely attended. Not many people want to see horror movies quite that early.
As we were coming in, there were a bunch of strollers because, of course, at 10:20 in the morning, there is a Mommy and Me music class, which makes a lot more sense than seeing a horror film at that time of day. But no, the issues happened at the 1 p.m. screening of Backrooms.
Because when we walked in, the movie had already started and this girl was in one of our seats. So obviously we politely asked her to move. She kind of huffed and puffed and was obviously annoyed and sat behind us.
Because the seating numbering is confusing. I don't know why they do it where it's like, instead of just 1, 2, 3, it's like 14, 1, 2. So I genuinely thought she was mistaken. When she huffed and puffed and then was like, it's not that big of a deal, is when I realized, like, oh, she's snuck into this movie.
Yes, absolutely. Which I do not begrudge a bitch that sneaks into a movie. We've all done it. It's fine. But when you sit in someone's assigned seats, you then have to move, especially when it's a packed movie like this one was.
Also, if you're going to sneak into a movie, I mean, be slicker at it. Sit in the first three rows, sit in the back row, stand in the goddamn aisle until 10 minutes into the film.
She was not that savvy. So I hear her say, it's not that fucking deep, which obviously pisses me off. I turn around and I'm like, excuse me, what's your problem?
You were also like, I mean, we paid for these seats. These are our seats. And then she said something along the lines of like, well, I'm smart enough. I'm smarter than you guys because I didn't pay to get into this movie.
She said, I don't have to pay like you losers.
Oh, God.
Is what she actually said. Then she called us dumb bitches.
Which is when Tat left to go get management to have her thrown out of the theater. Because we are cool with people sneaking into films up into a point.
Absolutely. And then, I don't know, we got into it. I do remember saying something to the effect of like, you are the rudest bitch that I've met in a really long time.
Which is when she stood up, called us dumb bitches again, and then spat on you.
Okay, to be fair, she attempted to spit on me, but because, I mean, she was looking kind of dehydrated, frankly, I think she didn't have enough saliva in her mouth to like actually get it to my face. It fell just short of my face. But obviously, I was enraged at that point.
And you went after her. So therefore, I was like, it's on. So I went after you.
Well, and we're now in a very loud screaming fight during a packed movie. So there is an audience.
And also, because the film has already started, this didn't even happen during the Nicole Kidman AMC ad. Like, you know, back rooms, this is not a spoiler, but
we're in the back rooms.
No, but like any horror film, it has a horror-esque cold open. So like people are screaming on screen while you're screaming at this woman.
So I'm screaming, this bitch spit on me. I'm chasing her out of the theater because she's run out, because she's about to get kicked out or whatever.
I'm now chasing Chelsea.
And then I guess Tat was coming back with one of the ushers. She heard me screaming about how this woman spit on me. So she just immediately jumped up and clocked her. Thank God.
Yes. I mean, this person was quite tall. It sort of, it landed somewhere in like the shoulder region.
Yeah, she had to jump up because this woman had some height, for sure. But I was so impressed with my knight in shining armor. You can't go around spitting in people's faces and expecting that they won't retaliate in a violent way.
Especially towards their wives, which when we all got back in our seats, we all turned around and apologized for the commotion. But Tat was like, this is my wife. Okay, I can't let that happen to my wife. And everyone was like, yeah.
Well, we did get 4 free passes to the AMC for some reason.
Forever?
No, not forever. Just like as an apology. The woman did get thrown out. I guess before we had even gotten in the theater, she had already gotten in an altercation with someone else. So they were just like done with her at that point, I guess. But it's crazy. It's been a long time since I've gotten in a really intense fight with a random person.
I don't know about you, but I was on edge the entire film. It was a real immersive experience for an anxiety-inducing movie.
Well, I was just glad that she was gone. But my favorite part was when she was screaming at the ushers, being like, this bitch assaulted me. And Tat was like, and I do it again, bitch. Slow clap.
I assume they gave us 4 free passes so we wouldn't go online and talk about it, which technically we're not. We just went on our podcast and discussed it.
Well, shout out to the manager of the AMC and the ushers. They were great.
So anyway, later in the episode, we'll get into our thoughts about the movie's obsession and backrooms. But now...
But also, I'm curious, Lauren, you didn't get into it with her. Why?
I guess the New Yorker in me was like, let the crazy person do the crazy thing and it will stop. But I always make this mistake that LA crazy, and I stand by this, LA crazy way crazier than New York crazy.
Well, you obviously have to make a call if someone that's accosting you is like a foaming at the mouth crazy person or just like a regular bitch. This chick was very much just a regular bitch. It didn't give me that vibe. But I don't know. If I was in my 20s, I think I would have just sat there and let her call me a bitch and then sat through the whole movie with her sitting behind me, being anxious, feeling like shit about myself. But now I just cannot let someone fuck with me like that.
I also thought she was going to leave the theater. Like, obviously, it turned when she spat on you, and that is, although you were chasing her, you could not see that I was chasing after you. Like, I was ready to get into it then. I was hoping she would just do her crazy thing, leave, and that would be the end of it.
Well, thankfully, we have Tatiana to defend us. Thank God. Because I would never get into a physical altercation with someone. I mean, obviously, she started it by spitting in my face.
Yeah, who could have predicted that?
Yeah, a low blow.
But I don't know if you remember this, but when we saw it opening weekend in the Cinerama Dome, there was nearly a fist fight in front of us because a person was on their phone and a guy got into it with him.
See, I love a fight in a movie theater.
Just not when you're the one on the receiving end.
No, I obviously don't like being assaulted by random crazy bitches at the Grove, but I appreciate the entertainment value of a fight in a movie theater. And I've seen some great ones. Once I was at the IFC Center and this chick had been texting like on her very bright, very large iPhone throughout the whole movie. So finally this guy just snapped, grabbed it out of her hand and threw it at the screen. And then they got into a physical fight and she chased him out. It was incredible. There's something about movie theaters where I do think people are weirdly close to snapping in certain scenarios.
Yeah, there was a lot of talking during the screening of Backrooms. I kind of shushed you guys because I was in such a panic state because obviously you and Tat were debriefing and I was like, guys, because I was afraid someone else would tell us to shut the fuck up and then another fight would erupt. But anyway.
No, everyone in the theater just felt bad for us.
So much so, and this is really telling of how much of a distinctive look you and Tatiana have. Someone that was in the theater that witnessed this, when we left the theater, we had gone to a couple stores, we were about to exit, stopped you and Tad and were like, we were there and we're so sorry that happened to you.
Well, we lived to tell the tale.
Today's episode is brought to you by Talkiatry. They make it easy to see a licensed psychiatrist online who takes your insurance in just a few days.
Oh, so this is for people who are on the verge of a MentiB, which is most of our audience.
Yes, Talkiatry gives you access to real psychiatric care with licensed clinicians who can diagnose and prescribe medication if it's right for you. It's a simple way to get effective treatment right from home. They are a 100% online psychiatry practice that provides comprehensive evaluations, diagnosis, and provides ongoing medication management for conditions like ADHD, anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, PTSD, insomnia.
Oh, I have insomnia. Maybe I should look into Talkiatry because clearly the melatonin gummies aren't doing it for me.
Unlike therapy-only platforms, Talkiatry is psychiatry. You're seeing a medical provider who can diagnose mental health conditions and prescribe medication when it's appropriate. All 800-plus clinicians are in-network with major insurers, so you can use your existing insurance instead of paying monthly subscriptions or out-of-network costs. You can meet with a licensed psychiatrist who takes time to understand what's going on, builds a personalized treatment plan, and supports you over time with consistent evidence-based care.
That sounds great. How do I get started?
Well, thanks for asking, Chell. It's so easy. It takes just a few minutes. Complete a short online assessment, get matched with clinicians who fit your needs, and schedule your first visit in days, not months. And because you continue with the same provider, you're not starting over each visit. Your treatment can evolve with you, so you're actually making progress over time.
Head to Talkiatry.com/outfit to complete the short assessment and get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes. That's Talkiatry.com/outfit to get matched in minutes.
All right, on to some diva news.
Yes, so much diva news this week. I did watch the Tonys. I was still a little bit tipsy from your child's birthday party, so I wouldn't say that I was as present as I could have been, but I did get the general gist.
I mean, I was busy cleaning up said child's birthday party, so I did not watch the Tonys.
You would never watch the Tonys.
I know, that was cope. I would never actually willingly watch the Tonys, but I can't imagine what it must have felt like being tipsy, being out in the sun all day, coming home, and then seeing Pink spinning as Peter Pan.
Yes, Pink was the host, and her opening number started as a tribute to the Mary Martin version of Peter Pan, because Pink is famously gender nonconforming and, like, addicted to flying.
Aerial stunts, yes.
She's never met a wire that she didn't love.
Well, I was under the impression that Pink was on Broadway, or maybe was announcing that she was going to be in a Broadway musical, but no, she's just hosting the Grammys.
Yeah, I have no idea why, but it kind of worked. Although, I don't know, there is something about an adult woman playing a little boy that has always really disturbed me. You know, like normally cross-dressing would be something that I'm into, but like, I don't want it like this.
I think the most upsetting woman as Peter Pan would be Allison Williams in that live musical on NBC of Peter Pan.
I totally forgot about that. Extremely disturbing.
Anyway, Pink is Peter Pan. Neil Patrick Harris goes on stage to stop her. She then lifts him up, which I'm like, is he on wires? Like, she lifted him up 15, 20 feet in the air, and it did not seem like he was attached to anything.
I think Neil Patrick Harris is like 80 pounds.
I mean, but even 80 pounds soaking wet, that is putting a lot of faith in the strength of Pink's thighs.
So basically the bit is that Neil Patrick Harris is like, you should just be yourself when you're hosting the Tonys. Like, you don't have to dress up as Peter Pan, be Pink. So then she does a rendition of Lady Marmalade, but they change it to Leading Lady Marmalade. And it involves a lot of the Best Actress nominees.
Getcha, Carrie Coon.
Getcha, Leslie Manville did get me. As well as Squibby June.
Oh, boy.
This did make me feel crazy.
Well, the other thing that made me feel crazy was a lot of people from Broadway participated in this, shows that were nominated, shows that were not nominated. And seeing Whitney Levitt, who is playing, I believe, Roxy Hart in Chicago, who comes from the real lives of Mormon wives,
mm-hmm.
was just crazy to see. Of like, you were a woman that was doing TikTok dances 6 years ago, and now you are coming to us live from the Tonys.
That is crazy. I didn't recognize her, obviously.
Well, she's had quite the glow up, let's say.
This performance is only going to hit for a very specific gay, like someone that wants Pink's version of Lady Marmalade to be interrupted by the child actors from the Ragtime revival.
That was upsetting.
Or like someone that enjoys Neil Patrick Harris in a like non-Gone Girl context, but also wants to see Megan Thee Stallion do the Lil' Kim part of Lady Marmalade.
Okay. There's a lot of crazy shit going on Broadway. That's what this year's Tonys taught me. One of which is that Megan Thee Stallion is in Moulin Rouge.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, she plays the MC, which is typically a male role. I had to look this up because I'm like, wait, is this just a special appearance or is she actually part of Broadway? And the answer is yes.
That's wild. See, I like watching the Tonys because I rarely have seen many of the plays or the musicals, you know? I grew up watching the show as a kid, never seen any of that shit. So I like to be acquainted with what's happening. Like, I didn't know that Moulin Rouge was on Broadway or that Ragtime was on Broadway and apparently is major. Who knew?
Who knew that Joel Schumacher's 1987 film The Lost Boys is now a musical and is evidently good, and so good that it is Tony nominated? You're telling me that the Heathers musical is not on Broadway anymore, but The Lost Boys is a runaway success?
Well, to be fair, the Heathers musical could have used some better music. But anyway, very intrigued about Lost Boys.
So it seems like there's a lot of revivals going on. Ragtime, Rocky Horror Picture Show is back.
Can't wait to see that. And that performance was good, I have to say. And Luke Evans, a very respectable Tim Curry, I thought.
Well, yeah. I mean, in the sense that every Hollywood actor needs to be jacked. He's the most jacked Dr. Frankenfurter I think we've ever seen.
Totally. I also love that Rachel Dratch is the person that explains to you how to do the time warp in the song.
Juliette Lewis is also evidently in this Rocky Horror Picture Show musical. I truly understand what Carrie Coon meant when she said in a recent CBS Sunday Morning interview, "I was in The White Lotus, so now I get to be in a Broadway play." It's all Hollywood actors now in plays and musicals.
Believe me, I've noticed. I forget, were you a Rocky Horror person at all?
I've dabbled in the Rocky Horror. I've been to the screenings. I do wonder, I mean, obviously the success of the Rocky Horror Show musical lends to the fact that it's still popular and in the zeitgeist. But I do wonder, do Gen Z kids still go to the midnight screenings?
I wonder, because you used to sort of have to go to the Rocky Horror midnight screenings if you were either like gay or trans or just kind of like gothic alternative or like fully perverted. You know, it was more like a meetup up for people in different subcultures.
Yeah, I feel like if you were an art school kid, which is how I identified in high school, like you had no choice but to go to Rocky Horror screenings.
Totally. I wasn't like obsessed with it. Like I would never say like I was like a big Rocky Horror person, but I probably went like 5 or 6 times when I was in high school.
Well, yeah, and it was also, I feel like, one of the sanctioned ways that you could get out of the house past midnight, where it's like, I'm not partying, Mom and Dad. I'm just going to a midnight screening of the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, it's like one of the few sort of adult things that you can do as a teenager that doesn't involve, like, drinking, you know? Because you can't go to bars and clubs and stuff when you're a teenager.
Very true. And you're not going to go to an all-ages club. Although I doubt in Humboldt there were all-ages clubs. That was more of a thing in LA.
No, there definitely were, but I would just like never set foot.
Of course not.
But Rocky people, like people that are really obsessed with it, are full-blown freaks.
Oh, yeah. There was a recent TikTok video about what happened to all the rockabillies, and the answer was that they become Disney adults. And I feel like that's in the world of people who are obsessed with the Rocky Horror Picture Show and make it their lifestyle.
Totally. And also, friend of the show, Leah Delaria, was in the previous Broadway revival of Rocky Horror. It was like her and Joan Jett. But she said that it was like kind of a nightmare because all of the Rocky Horror people that see the movie like every single weekend would now be seeing the show every single day. And they have like no boundaries in the sense that, like, you know, the part where like there's the wedding and you throw rice at the screen.
Yes.
She said people would smuggle in like 20 pound bags of rice, throw them on the stage, then like the dancers would fall and like shit like that.
Yikes.
Yeah, they're crazy.
The original parasocial relationship.
Totally.
Can we discuss the Book of Mormon performance? Because it's the rare example, we were just talking about how many Hollywood stars are in musical, but it's the rare example of musical stars that because of the success of a Broadway show became big Hollywood stars who are now returning to reprise their roles. I am, of course, referring to Andrew Rannells and Josh Gad, who originated the roles in Book of Mormon, came back for a 15th anniversary performance.
Look, Man Up is not my favorite Book of Mormon song, but I feel like they needed to give Josh Gad his Tony's moment because when it was first nominated, Andrew Rannells did a solo performance of I Believe, which is like the big song or the best Tony's song from Book of Mormon, I would say.
Right.
So this time it was Man Up into, fuck, I forget.
Don't look at me, I won't know the answer.
It was good.
I used to bounce from one product to the next, never sticking to any one product or routine because it was either too complicated or too expensive to continue with. That's why I now use Naturium. Naturium is clinically effective skincare for everyone, everywhere, every day. I used Naturium before they became a sponsor of this podcast. My gateway product was the Multi-Peptide Moisturizer. The sleek, well-designed packaging first caught my eye. Then I saw it had a bunch of great ingredients like squalene and niacinamide. I pair it with the niacinamide cleanser and their intense overnight sleeping cream at night, and I wake up the next morning looking like $1 million. Although it won't cost you that. What I love about Naturium is that they've made skincare an affordable luxury that you can use every day. And let's be honest, consistency is the key to good skin. And through this podcast ad, I'm learning they have a club. Yes, the Consistency Club is where you can sign up, earn points, redeem rewards at no additional cost or a subscription. Even your empty bottles earn points because your best skin starts with a consistent routine. I've signed up for this, you should too. Give your skin the affordable, luxurious glow it deserves. Go to Naturium.com/outfit for 10% off your first purchase today. That's Naturium.com/outfit.
Also, I talked to someone who went to see the Book of Mormon recently, and Jeffrey Epstein and Charlie Kirk have been added to the spooky Mormon hell dream sequence.
Right. Andrew Rannells and Josh Gad were interviewed sometime after the Tonys, where they were being asked, what was it like? Was it like riding a bike, doing the performance again? They were saying, yeah, the first time we rehearsed, we had no idea what we were doing. By the second time, we fell back into it, but they were noting that in the 15 years, there have been so many added references and jokes that's where they were like, wait, what?
Did you see the original cast of Book of Mormon?
I think I did. I must have, because that's when we were living in New York. And I think that was one of those things where my parents came to town. That was the big musical and we went.
Yeah, I saw the original cast. And then I saw it maybe like 12 years ago. In New York, Gavin Creel, may he rest in peace, was in the Andrew Rannells role. Also amazing. It is just such a timeless and incredible show. But it is shocking that it is still on Broadway, just because it is so subversive.
It has continuously been running for 15 years.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I think so.
I think you are correct in that. Should we talk about some notable winners?
Sure.
So I'm obsessed with the show that won Best Musical, which is Schmegadoon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm obsessed with this only because it was a canceled Apple TV series. Did you know that this was an Apple TV series?
Yes, and I've been meaning to watch it forever because I love the premise. It's basically about a couple who their relationship is on the rocks. I think they're on like a backpacking trip or something like that. And then they basically like find this town and everyone is like trapped in a mid-century musical, essentially, and so are they. And they can't get out until they like repair their relationship.
The irony or the humor that it was a television series that was a musical that got canceled. So then they just made it a traditional musical that has now won Best Musical.
It's great. Julie Klausner wrote for the TV show, so I always wanted to see it. I'm sure it's hilarious.
Our girl Leslie Manville won Best Actress for Oedipus.
Bless.
John Lithgow won over Nathan Lane for the play Giant, which at first I was like, oh, they adapted the film Giant, but it's like, no, this is about how Roald Dahl is an anti-Semite.
Yes.
And then Laurie Metcalf won Best Featured Actress for Death of a Salesman.
That's also what Nathan Lane was in.
Nathan Lane was in Death of a Salesman, yes.
Also desperate to see that. Supposed to be fab. I also loved when Maya Rudolph and Cole Escola presented. Very funny. Very funny joke about Oedipus, where Cole was like, a play that asked the question, can women really have it all?
It was really fucking good.
So good.
I know Maya Rudolph was in O Mary. Is she still in O Mary?
I think she's still in O Mary.
Okay.
And it is pretty crazy that she's in O Mary, Anna Gasteyer is in Schmigadoon, and Rachel Dratch is in Rocky Horror simultaneously.
Tina Fey's dance card, very busy. She's promoting the Four Seasons. She's got Knicks games to go to, and half of her female cast members at SNL are in Broadway plays or musicals that she must see. Can I ask you a question? Why was Rosie O'Donnell there?
Rosie O'Donnell has always been a huge Broadway person. She's hosted a million times.
She's a Tony's ally, is what you're saying.
Yeah. If she presented, I missed that.
Same, but I only watch clips from the Tonys. But what I did see was her being interviewed on the red carpet about her facelift, which we briefly touched on a few weeks ago. But the clip that I saw, Rosie was discussing the fact that not since she had her talk show has the paparazzi met her at the airport and they wanted to photograph her new face, which I gotta say, looks great.
It looks so good. I'm so happy for her. I knew that she had fucked up the facelift reveal by posting selfies.
Well, she hard launched her facelift with a before and after that did not really look like a before and after. And then also did a very extensive Substack post about it.
Yes. She wrote a very long poem that kind of started being more about her facelift and how she always considered herself to be the kind of woman that would never have a facelift.
Oh, Chelsea, I have the poem right here if you would like me to read a few words from it.
Please do.
And this is from her Substack, Roro Subs. My life post TikTok and IG here in Ireland and around the world, save democracy, resist. In a May 25th post, she wrote or poemed, I used to feel very strongly about facelifts, not casually, morally. I had assigned myself as head of all women who would never, ever. I thought it was a betrayal of feminism, of aging, of our team of women worldwide. And then I lost 50 pounds. I can go on if you would like.
No, it's okay. You don't have to. Unless you want to get into the part where her
13-year-old
non-binary child told her she couldn't get a facelift.
Because I wouldn't be able to respect you if you did it. I wanted a limit. I wanted to still be me, just less haunted. And it worked. I do look like me. A slightly more well-rested, emotionally stable version of me. I'm quite pleased with the whole thing.
As she should be. It's the most natural, flattering, restrained facelift possible.
Or, as she says at the end of her poem, it's what a lower, deep plane facelift looks like when it minds its own business.
Good for her.
I think she wrote this poem and hard launched her facelift because at one point during her poem, she goes, and guess what? No one has noticed. Not one person, not a friend, not a stranger, not even people who owe me compliments. I think she wanted people to be like, holy shit, you look great. And she does.
Well, now she's getting that because she's stepped out of the house wearing makeup with her new facelift instead of just posting a selfie like taken from below backlit, like in a scary little room in Ireland.
I think that 13-year-old was still mad that she got the facelift. So they were like, I'm going to take a shitty photo of you to show it off.
Also, I saw Rosie post on Instagram that it is the 30th anniversary of the Rosie O'Donnell show, which is crazy.
Yes, it is. A perfect time capsule. I'm glad she ended the show when she did.
Yeah.
Because then we would have never gotten her on The View.
This is true.
Is that your favorite era of The View?
With Rosie?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
First time, not second time.
Yes, first time, I would say. Second time got a little toxic because she never really got on with Whoopi, and that was always weird. But she was so genius on The View. I really wish there was a progressive voice like her on The View presently. But what can you do?
That's a whole other episode that I would love to hear, and I'm sure other fuckettes would, which is your fan casting of The View.
Once again, we have been blessed because this episode is sponsored by The RealReal, the world's largest and most trusted source for authenticated luxury resale.
Chelsea and I both shop and sell on The RealReal, which is great because we can get rid of the clothes that we never wear and replace them with pieces that we are actually excited about.
So what have you bought recently?
Well, I have been seeing a lot of cool girls wear this jean brand called Still Here, and they're a little expensive, and so I went on The RealReal because I wanted a pair of Still Here jeans that have little cuts around the knees.
Oh, I think I've seen you in those.
Yes, they're my new favorite jeans. I wear them all the time, and I got them for a steal on The RealReal.
See, I've been trying to avoid buying clothes, although I'm always lurking. I'm always watching. I'm always checking my obsessions and seeing if they've sold or not. I have been contemplating this like really insane 80s gown. I will not mention the designer because I don't want anyone to get ideas and steal it from me, but it is non-returnable. So if it looks bad on me, that sucks. But also, you can sell things back to The RealReal, even if you can't return them, which is cool.
And when you sell with The RealReal, they do everything for you, from photography and copywriting to shipping, pricing, and customer service, so you can just sit back and get paid. Plus, with over 42 million fashion lovers on The RealReal, your items will sell fast, and The RealReal makes it so easy. Resale is what they do, so you have time to do you.
The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. With over 10,000 new arrivals daily, no one does resale like The RealReal. Get $25 off your first purchase when you go to therealreal.com/outfit. Plus, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. That's therealreal.com/outfit. TheRealReal.com/outfit.
But moving on, Madonna released a short film. Is that what we're calling this? It's 13 minutes long. Well, it's 10 minutes with 3 minutes of credits at the end.
Yeah. And it was essentially a medley of, I think, 6 different songs from the upcoming Confessions 2 album, directed by Torso, who have had a really major month between this and the Charlie XCX video that we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Do you think this is the way to go with our attention deficit economy that, you know, if Beyonce pioneered the visual album where every single song on the album gets a music video, this is sort of like, what if I gave you a 2-minute music video for 6 songs that will be on this album?
I think it's great. I'm a huge Madonna fan, but this is the first music video I've liked of hers in a really, really long time. Like, I obviously have lingering trauma from Bitch, I'm Madonna and all of that, you know?
When was her last good music video? The one with Justin Timberlake?
I would say before that.
An American Life?
Probably, yeah. I think the Hollywood music video was probably the last Madonna video that like was really on my radar in an intense way, although she did get sued by the Guy Bourdin estate, and I believe she settled with them.
I was just about to say, I think why we love it is because it rips off Guy Bourdin photographs, so much so that you are correct, his estate sued her.
I wonder if the Guy Bourdin estate is coming for Paper Magazine because of that photo shoot they just released with Meg Stalter and Paul Downs, which recreated the sort of French-made Guy Bourdin photo, which I think Madonna also did recreate in the Hollywood
music video. Yeah. I do love that, again, are we calling it a short film, a music video?
I'm calling it a music video.
Okay. I do love that the music video opens with this play on this action movie trope where, like, you know, the SWAT team is coming in with their guns and their scopes out, but instead it's just scantily clad BDSM masked women with Steadicams.
Yeah, it's like a SWAT team of, like, Mugler models, essentially.
One of which is Lourdes, who's revealed later in the music video.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have what I'm calling the Jennifer Lopez waiting for tonight green laser beams coming out of dancers' assholes.
And vaginas. That was my favorite part. I loved that. That I have never seen before.
There really needs to be a word beyond camp, because that's what this music video is.
Yeah, I don't know that that's camp. It is outrageous. Is what it is. It's funny, deliberately so.
I mean, there is a lot going on. At one point, there is a first-person POV shot of car footage of presumably Madonna driving a car very fast, which feels like the beginning of Basic Instinct 2, mm-hmm. If you know, you know.
Yes. Also a bit of a smack my bitch up vibe. I liked the part where the car crashes and there's a lipstick print on the airbag.
There's a brief interlude with Sabrina Carpenter, their song that they have together on the album that they performed at Coachella. But I think the part that everyone's talking about is the section for the song Danceteria, which is where you get Julia Garner, Richard E. Grant, Kate Moss, Debbie Mazur, Gwendolyn Christie, Benedict Cumberbatch.
That was random.
So I was looking around to see if there was any connection between the two, and all I could find was that Benedict Cumberbatch had auditioned for Madonna, and it did not go well, and he told the story on Graham Norton.
Didn't you audition for Madonna, Benedict?
Oh, God, yes, I did. She just sort of came in breezily, very late, and had a clipboard in hand, and I said, yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch, is that really your name? And I went, yes, it is, Madonna.
What was he auditioning for?
I have to guess that it was for that film she directed about Wallace Simpson.
I guess that makes a bit more sense, but he did feel a little random considering, like, Debbie Mazur, we obviously understand why she was there. She was physically present at Danceteria. Honey Dijon, an iconic nightlife personality, that makes sense. Same with Arca, Kate Moss, Gwendolyn Christie.
Well, Madonna saying cocaine and then Kate Moss appearing.
I wonder if they, like, cleared that with her first.
I think so. They must have.
I would think so, too.
Well, can we get into Julia Garner's inclusion in this music video? Because the fact that Julia Garner, who was cast in the Madonna biopic that Madonna was going to direct and then promptly fell apart, it just seems like Julia Garner is her de facto avatar, because we know in the next season of The Studio, there's going to be a plot point about Madonna making a biopic about herself with Julia Garner that will be featured in the show.
I love that. And Julia Garner is, like, permanently stuck in the true blue Madonna era.
Blonde, curly, pale.
It's like the perfect look for that. We also saw interesting details, like an actor playing Martin Burgoyne, who is one of Madonna's closest friends and early collaborators, name dropped in the Danceteria song, of course. I also like how they recreated the moment where Madonna famously went to Danceteria, handed the DJ a cassette single of Everybody.
Right.
They played it, and that's how she started her career, essentially. So much lore in this video and in that song.
Very full circle. So we are mere weeks away from Confession 2 coming out.
Also, I don't know if you watched the credits, but did you see that this music video was powered by Dolce & Gabbana?
I did see that, yes.
I also feel like Grindr must have given them some money, because you see the Grindr logo in a bathroom stall. Also, Grindr, I believe, did pay for the Times Square performance that she did for this album in conjunction with New York Pride.
Right. And thanks to Grindr, we got the answer of who was the best in bed, according to Madonna. And because she said JFK Jr., but do you know the context of why she said JFK Jr.?
because she said she'd only talk about dead people?
Yes.
Like, was it Warren Beatty? We don't know.
I think in her mind, she said it in Truth or Dare. I think still to this day, the love of her life is Sean Penn. I don't co-sign on that. I just unfortunately think that that is true.
Also, I'll link to it in the show notes, but if you are a Madonna fan, you have to listen to the Madonna series on the podcast Bandsplain, which is hosted by Yossi Salik. It traces Madonna's entire career over several different episodes. And there's a lot of amazing guests that have been on every outfit, like Mel Ottenberg, Patrick Sandberg. It's a really incredible public service for the true Madonna heads. And the Madonna curious, I suppose. Oh, also, have you seen that clip of Linda Perry talking shit about Madonna that has been circulating recently?
Maybe.
She basically said, I've always wanted to collaborate with Madonna. Madonna never wanted to record any of my songs. But also, she is really salty and she's basically like, Madonna used to be a leader and now she's a follower. She's trying to compete with Charlie, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
It's tough. I mean, it's a real substance situation going on. You know, you would not have Charlie, you wouldn't have Sabrina without Madonna, but now she is, by virtue of putting out an album in the same pop culture space that these two exist in, you know, in competition with them.
Totally. Charlie definitely wouldn't exist if not for Madonna. But also, I have noticed that Madonna is hiring a lot of Charlie's collaborators, including like the same art director that did the Brat album cover, did the Confessions album cover, obviously Torso, did a lot of stuff for Charlie. I think Madonna's also now using her hairstylist, or at least did on this project.
That's interesting.
And then the Times Square performance also. But, you know, no shade. She also kind of has to hire the best people, so I get it.
Yeah. Is she a follower or is she just hiring the best people of the moment, which has always been her thing?
Well, clearly someone on her team is making really good decisions around this album, because that hasn't historically been the case, or the last few albums have been hard for me. You know, I never got into the rebel heart of it all.
No, that doesn't exist in my mind.
So it's really nice to see her do stuff like this that seems to be resonating with people and is cool.
I'm thrilled to have Wayfair back as a sponsor. As I've spoken about before, Wayfair was an essential resource during my home renovation, from storage solutions to kitchen hardware, even toilets. Wayfair not only had it, but for cheaper than anywhere else, and it arrived fast. Well, my journey continues. With summer upon us, it's time to tackle the backyard. And Wayfair has it all. Outdoor seating, grills, major appliances, storage, patio lighting, rugs, decor. Wayfair is your one-stop shop for home. In particular, I've used Wayfair to outfit Morty's outdoor play area. I found this adorable 3-in-1 sand and water table that also converts into a picnic table with umbrella and storage inside. I got this adorable metal swing that he absolutely loves, and I have my eye on a swing set with a slide and rock climbing wall. He's not of the age to use it yet, but when he is, I will be ordering it from Wayfair, not just because they have the best prices, but also because they have installation and assembly services available. Because outdoor furniture is heavy and intimidating to assemble, and I love that Wayfair deals with the hard parts so that I don't have to. Also, are you like me and have decision fatigue? Well, with over 20 million five-star reviews, you can hear from real customers before you buy. Patio season is here and these deals won't last. Head to wayfair.com right now to get your outdoor space ready for way less. That's WAYFAIR.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
All right. Shall we discuss this Marissa Berenson Zara collection?
Sure.
For those who don't know, Marissa Berenson, model, actress, granddaughter of Elsa Schiaparelli,
style icon, friend of Liza. As we learned from Liza Minnelli's memoir, Marissa Berenson is still one of her closest friends, a million years after they starred in Cabaret together.
Do you think Marissa Berenson gifted her good friend Liza Minnelli some of these wares from her Zara collection?
I hope so. At the very least, the turbans would be perfect for Liza.
Marissa, these turbans are great!
I'm trying to imagine how Liza Minnelli would pronounce Zara. It might be weird.
I think she would pronounce it the way that Kanye does, or Ye does. Zara.
Zara.
That's it.
Yeah. Now, that's me doing an impression of the AI voice of Liza Minnelli that we heard in her audiobook. To my knowledge, this is the first Zara collaboration collection that spans from clothing to home goods.
Yes. In between this Zara's Willy Chavarria collaboration and this upcoming Galliano partnership, someone there is making smart decisions.
Yes, it does make it difficult to be an ethical shopper and not shop fast fashion when the collaborations are this good.
Well, I do think it's cool that they clearly are trying to differentiate themselves from Fashion Nova and H&M and, you know, whoever.
Shein.
Shein, of course.
I also think there is a concerted effort to, even though they are a fast fashion label, to create products that you keep for more than a season.
Yeah.
They're trying to be not as trendy. Because, you know, if you're thinking of the youth audience, I don't know if you necessarily think of Marissa Berenson.
No, this is definitely engineered towards older people. Although on the clothing side, I liked that there were pieces that young Marissa Berenson would have worn and pieces that present-day Marissa Berenson would wear. There's something for everyone.
So what did you purchase from this collection? Because this is very Chelsea Fairless coded.
Totally. I did a pretty conservative buy on this one. I got a turban, a black turban with sequins.
Now, where do you plan to wear that?
I don't know. With a black gown to something. It's not as if I've never worn a turban before, although it has been a minute.
I thought you were going to be like around the house. Duh.
I got that. I got a fan, like a paper fan that has her face on it, which is the most bizarre thing that they made.
Did you get the mirror?
No, it's a fan. It's not a mirror.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's a paper fan. I at first thought it was like a handheld mirror, but no. And then I got this tassel necklace with a shell on it that will just work with all of my black caftans and stuff.
I mean, I don't know how much of each SKU was produced, but I'm looking at the website now. Pretty much everything, especially the home goods, are sold out.
I think the home goods are better than the actual clothes on the whole.
Yeah. The clothing quality-wise, you never know with the photos, could be quite hit or miss. I'm surprised you didn't get this long pink kind of polo V-neck dress.
I saw that. I didn't get it because it's linen.
Mm.
And I have some linen stuff, like some linen caftan type dresses, but I don't need a lot of them because I'm too like OCD for it.
The boots look pretty fab, although I'm just personally not a wedge boot person.
No, no one should be a wedge boot person.
Except Marissa Berenson.
Except Marissa.
All right, moving on. The long rumored Romy and Michelle sequel is finally in production. Hallelujah.
Yeah, although I feel like the image that they released to announce this was definitely AI.
Oh, yeah, because it's purportedly, or at least I guess we're supposed to get the sense that it's Lisa Kudrow, Mira Sorvino, seen from the back in their director's chairs in a location that is
of diner on a soundstage.
And they're holding hands as if they're Thelma and Louise about to cruise off a mountain range.
That did disturb me a little bit.
The final ride, Romy and Michelle.
Just the AI of it all. It made me scared about the costume design a little bit. Although, because it's an AI image, I assume this isn't what it will actually look like.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned costumes. I went to the IMDb page to look at who was working on the film because a lot of the original cast, the original writer, Robin Schiff, is coming back to write it, although it's a different director. I wonder if Mona May is coming back to do costumes.
I hope so.
Presumably, the plot of the film is that it is now their 30th, 40th, potentially, high school reunion.
Oh, God, if it's their 40th reunion, I'm going to kill myself.
Probably 30th reunion, because they graduated in 1986. The first film was their 10th year anniversary, which was 1996. Would have been cool if they could have gotten their act together so this film could have come out in 2026, but it will be coming out next year in 2027.
streaming. They're not going to put this in theaters, which I think is a very dumb move if The Devil Wears Prada 2 box office is anything to go by.
Yeah. It's going to be on Hulu and Disney Plus, allegedly. But in a bit of good news, it is confirmed that Alan Cumming, Janine Garofalo, and Cameron Manheim are all returning.
But what about that fabulous lesbian who worked for Vogue?
I hope she's coming back too.
And they are also adding Keegan-Michael Key, Robin Hubel, Breckin Meyer, Patrick Warburton. Curious what roles they will be filling. Very curious to know what has become of Romy and Michelle's clothing line.
Yeah.
I imagine that their clothing line maybe went the way of the Juicy Couture girls or Betsy Johnson, where it got bought by some conglomerate that drove it into the ground. And now, like, old Romy and Michelle pieces are grail pieces online.
Yeah, I wonder. Also, is Lisa Kudrow still married to Alan Cumming?
I'm going to guess that they're divorced and she got a huge payout in the divorce.
Also, this isn't on the doc, but have you seen the trailer for this Legally Blonde prequel series?
I pressed play and then noped out after the first 10 seconds. But it seems like you watched it, so tell me.
I watched it. It's an interesting premise because the whole thing is that young Elle Woods obviously grew up in Bel Air or whatever, but at some point during high school, her parents moved to Seattle, and it's like peak 90s grunge sort of culture.
Wait. I'm sorry. So this is the movie Fear, which Reese Witherspoon starred in as a teenager who lived in Seattle.
Basically. And she obviously doesn't fit in at the high school in Seattle. And I'm kind of into this premise.
Really?
I know the show is going to be trash, but will I watch it? Yes, I will.
Will I have it on in the background as I fold laundry? Of course.
And so will you. So don't act like you're above watching the Legally Blonde prequel series coming soon to
Amazon?
Yeah.
Well, I need something to hold me over before the streaming release of Romy and Michelle. Oh, that's the other movie I was going to reference. Goddamn Hocus Pocus 3 is going to be a theatrical release. We can't get a Romy and Michelle sequel theatrically released?
Okay, well, at least it's happening for Hocus Pocus 3. Hocus Pocus 2 was not so fortunate.
All right, let's move on from movies we want to see to movies we actually saw.
Starting with Obsession.
My expectation for this film was pretty high. It's been out for almost a month. It has amazing word of mouth. And usually when that happens, I come away being disappointed, but I fucking love the movie.
Yeah, it's great. And it falls within a film genre that we love, which is Girlfriend from Hell.
Yeah, I mean, this is more like BPD Girlfriend from Hell.
Yeah, but is that not also Fatal Attraction?
Very true. This movie is also, I mean, the simplest logline, right? Guy is infatuated with girl, can't share his feelings, so instead he finds a magical stick that will grant any wish. He wishes that she will be obsessed with him, and she is, to devastating results.
Be careful what you wish for.
But I do think this is such a successful horror film because it plays into an incel's fantasy, and it is played out to its logical, although unbelievably heightened and horrifying conclusion.
Yeah. I don't think the goal of this film was to make a feminist horror movie, but it is one, because the female protagonist is put under this spell, forced to date and fuck this guy that she's not interested at all. And pretty immediately she starts getting revenge and making his life a living hell. And I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it wasn't the Fatal Attraction type ending that I was expecting.
This movie, for me, I felt like it referenced so many other films in a great way. Like, there's always this intention in Hollywood to remake already successful films instead of borrowing from movies that worked or didn't work to create something new. Like, the wish logic of this film reminded me so much of Bedazzled,
mm-hmm.
where because it's such a simplistic wish, there's all this room for it to go wrong.
Yeah, and it is a subversion of the manic pixie dream girl trope also.
It also did something that is my pet peeve with psychological horror films or psychological thrillers, where oftentimes it's like, is something supernatural happening, or is this person just mentally ill? And oftentimes at the end of these types of movies, it's like, she was just mentally ill or he was just mentally ill. And in this film, it's great because there is a supernatural reason why this girl is acting this way. But everyone around them, the two main characters, just think that she's having a manic episode.
It's great. And it's really funny. It also kind of reminded me of The Crush, that Alicia Silverstone movie, just in the humor of it. In the humor of this hot girl sort of acting in these increasingly deranged ways.
Yeah. Do you remember in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days when Kate Hudson crashes Matthew McConaughey's Guy's Night?
No, I don't remember that. It's been too long.
That's essentially how this character behaves. Like, Kate Hudson is so deranged. That's another, I think, whether the writer-director Curry Barker meant to satirize this. But, you know, there was a certain point in rom-coms where women were just acting fucking insane for the premise of the romantic comedy, where it's like, oh, they're just crazy. Like, people would be disturbed by this behavior. And I saw a Letterboxd review for Obsession that was like, this is just Sex and the City from Big's perspective.
Totally. The script is obviously fantastic, but what makes this movie great is the performance by Indy Navarrete. Navarrete? I don't know, but she's a genius. And I feel like this is one of the all-time great horror performances.
It is a star-making role for sure.
Because normally a performance that over the top and animated would be too funny to be genuinely scary, but she managed to accomplish both somehow. And I think this woman has an incredible career ahead of her, at the very least as a scream queen.
Yeah, it's an interesting performance because it is dramatic, as you spoke about. You would think because, or at least I thought going into this film, a 26-year-old guy wrote and directed this film. He has primarily a comedy YouTube background, that there wasn't going to be this rich interior life in the female character. And there is. This actress can go in many directions. She can go in comedy, she can go in drama. It's, as I said, a star-making performance.
And the lead actor is great also, although he did look way too much like Charlie Kirk, let's be real. Not his fault, but especially after the non-consensual haircut that he received in this film.
The non-consensual haircut he received?
Remember when he woke up and was like, hey, did you cut my hair?
Oh, I might have gone to the bathroom during that scene. Another thing that I enjoyed about this movie, and it's something that it shares with The Substance, is the vague customer service person that, like, is not helpful at all.
Yes.
You just go with it, but, like, the logic magic is never really explained in this film, which is absolutely fine with me. But I do love how, in The Substance and this film, unlike the show The Beauty, which is a batshit show with many problems, but, like, if there was a substance or a magical solution that can make you younger or grant any of your wishes, I'm sorry, you don't think a billionaire would be trying to market this? Like, in The Substance and this film, there are these obscure toys.
Mm-hmm.
They are sold for a relatively economic value.
Yeah, this movie also reminded me of The Craft a bit because of the constant returning to the witch store or the crystal store or wherever he bought this thing.
Yeah, I do wonder if Curry Barker is a fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because the magic store in this film is very similar to the magic box in Buffy, where the proprietors are very sarcastic and you are unsure of, like, do they know what's going on? Are they behind all of this? What's happening?
It is very funny that throughout the film, no one seems to care about his predicament, really.
Well, he doesn't let anyone in.
There's that. But ultimately, I feel like this is a movie about how young people struggle with dating and with in-person communication.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit after the movie. You were like, that's the most unrealistic part, that he couldn't just say to a girl that he likes her. I'm like, I think, and I'm going to sound 100 years old when I say this, but, like, that is an issue with Gen Z. Like, they are dating less, they're having sex less. And I wonder if part of the success of this film and why it resonates with the younger audience is it is, for the first time in media, kind of displaying that
predicament that the Gen Z and Gen Alpha has with interpersonal relationships.
Totally. This man would rather cast a spell than risk being rejected by a girl that he likes.
So, as I was saying, this film was written and directed by Curry Barker. He is a 26-year-old. He and his friend Coop, who plays the lead's best friend in the film, they have a YouTube channel which has over 1 million subscribers called That's a Bad Idea. How this film came to be, because I don't think since the Blair Witch Project, there has been a low-budget film with essentially no stars that has grossed hundreds of millions of dollars. I know you might say Insidious, but I don't know. It feels quite similar to the phenomenon that was the Blair Witch Project.
Totally.
So I guess Curry Barker in 2023 did a short film called The Chair, which from the logline seems to be about a haunted chair, which garnered 10 million views on YouTube. You can still watch it on YouTube to this day. It caught the attention of a producer at a production company called T-Shop. The film was financed by a company called Capstone for only $750,000. It premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, where there was a bidding war. Focus Features won, buying the film for $15 million. Focus Feature is the independent label under Universal, which also is home to Blumhouse, which is their horror arm. This is where Jason Blum was brought in on as a producer. I am explaining all of this in granular detail because its runway success, at the time of the recording, the worldwide box office has it sitting at $234 million, has led to some controversy, especially in the film Twitter Reddit world. Last week, the art director of Obsession, Sally Choi, went on Instagram to discuss what she feels was unfair wages that she was paid in light of the film's financial success. She says that she made only $300 a day, which came out to $6,741 after taxes. This has caused an interesting conversation. I think in light of the film's success, she feels, rightly so, that those that participate, especially below the line, should be compensated with bonuses. But I don't think that was ever in the contract. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, if a little independent film ends up doing crazy numbers like this, of course people should be compensated. But if that wasn't part of anyone's contract, it's not really on the creators to go back and retroactively pay people.
Well, also, the way that film financing works is that, yes, it's made $230 million, but you cut that in half because theaters get half of those tickets. You also have the people who get paid first. It came out this week that Jason Blum is potentially getting a $17 million payout, even though he's a producer basically in name only after the film was made. Although, because he has Blumhouse, which has done movies like Get Out and a bunch of other horror films, probably his marketing of the film has helped make it the success that it is. But it came out the other day that the company that financed the film, Capstone, will be seeing $45 to $50 million from the success of the film. According to the Wrap, they will share this with the creative team, including Curry Barker. But to Sally Cho's point, in her Instagram post, she is below the line. And who's to say that her or other people below the line would see a bonus? It's sort of a catch-22, because if I were Curry Barker or Capstone, I would, even though it's not in the contract, be giving people bonuses.
For sure. It's the right thing to do.
However, when I read that post and I talked to other people who work in the industry, we all had the same second thought, which was no one's going to hire her again.
No, of course not.
By the way, that's not me saying that she shouldn't get hired. It's just a really fucked up reality of the world. Like, she might be the reason that people will get bonuses, but she probably won't get a job because people are going to be too worried that, you know, if she is treated in a way that she doesn't like, she's just going to go public.
Right. For sure. And she did agree to the rate that she did the movie for also.
And also, this is such a one in a million shot, how successful this movie is.
Yeah, and it does suck that she is probably going to be punished for this when it should be such a great thing for her career.
Because the production design, so she's an art director, which means she did set dressing. She gets into this post that, you know, when you work on an independent feature of this small size, you wear many hats. So she was set dresser, PA, background actor. The film looks incredible, we should say.
Yeah, it does. Even though it's very simple, there's not many locations. It's very bare bones, although you don't really notice that.
There is a bar scene towards the beginning of the film, and I was like, wow, this scene has more extras than a cafe scene in And Just Like That.
Okay, well, And Just Like That really set a new standard with that. Especially season one, pandemic season, when it's literally just like Carrie and Seema in an empty restaurant.
So reportedly, Curry Barker's next film is to direct the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake.
Cool.
Which I guess it will be the second remake?
I don't think I saw the first one, but I'm also not a big Texas Chainsaw Massacre person. Not my favorite.
Yeah, I don't need something inspired by Ed Gein. I'm okay. I didn't watch that season of Monsters.
Yeah.
Silence of the Lambs is as far as I go in kind of any Ed Gein flavored horror. All right, should we talk about Backrooms?
Sure, which I really enjoyed despite my somewhat traumatic movie going experience.
I left the theater and I said to you, I'm like, I don't even know if I enjoyed that film. Because I spent the first half of it in such an anxious state. And it was a packed theater. There were a lot of people talking throughout the film, which is fine. But also a lot of people getting up from their seats. And I was like, I'm ready to go.
Like, is that bitch coming back? Yeah, I liked it. Not as much as Obsession, which is not Backroom's fault.
Or that woman who accosted us fault.
But I thought it was a solid horror movie. And it's not really like anything else. It is original.
You are correct. I think my favorite part of the film is at a certain point when Chiwetel Ejiofor is exploring the back rooms, you turn to me and you go, I would love this gallery.
Yeah, if I was down there, I would be like, whose fabulous gallery is this? Because that's exactly what it looks like. And the production design in that film draws so much from contemporary art and from sculptures that are made with furniture, found objects, what have you.
And Kane Parsons, who is the director of the film, only 20 years old. He created a series of short films on YouTube. YouTube again. About the Backrooms, which is, do you know the lore of Backrooms?
A little bit, but why don't you explain?
Yes, given that our audience is elder millennials like us, I'm sure that they are not current on the Backroom lore, which started from a photo that was posted in 2019 on 4chan. Only in 2024 did people discover where the original photo was actually taken, which it was taken in 2002 as a former site of an Oshkosh, Wisconsin furniture store.
Oh, not like Oshkosh Bagosh.
No. Oshkosh, Wisconsin. But then someone added this paragraph to the photo, and then this is how the lore of Backrooms really got started. If you're not careful and you no-clip out of reality in the wrong areas, you'll end up in the back rooms, where it's nothing but the stink of old moist carpet, the madness of mono yellow, the endless background noise of fluorescent lights at maximum hum buzz, and approximately 600 million square miles of randomly segmented empty rooms to be trapped in. God save you if you hear something wandering around nearby, because it sure as hell has heard you.
So just some random person posted this?
Yep.
Did they get credit?
I don't believe so. I believe it was an anonymous account. Kane Parsons is not the one that wrote that. I also noticed he didn't write the script to Backrooms, which is interesting. So the phrase noclip, which I had to go look up, is a video game term, which means to navigate through a game environment with collisions disabled so that you are able to pass through solid walls. Which would explain the main conceit of this film, which is that you can just pass through walls.
One wall, specifically. Guys, I'm not even going to try to explain this movie because it's impossible to describe.
No, I think the more interesting thing and why I wanted to get into the creator of Backrooms and its lore is that, as you pointed out, there is so many fine art references, including at one point a very Basquiat-esque mural.
The Basquiat mural took me out because I was already like wrapping my head around the sort of Urs Fischer, Robert Gober looking sculptures and installations in the back rooms. But Basquiat was crazy.
And I tried to look for interviews where maybe Cain Parsons referenced his love of fine art. I could not find anything. So it's just an interesting case of parallel thinking, because so much of the art and architecture of the back rooms is clearly from fine art that probably these teenagers that were writing this creepypasta had no conception of.
Totally. That's all on the production designer. But it even goes beyond those sorts of fine artists. There is also like fashion stuff in there, like the piles of clothes in the back rooms. That reminded me of, remember when Vetements did all of those window displays everywhere? There was one at Maxfield. It was just like a giant pile of clothes.
Right.
Or like when they started meeting like the people in the back rooms, like the guy that has three faces and he had that polo shirt where the collar of the polo shirt and the neck was like on the chest of the shirt. I was like, that is like that Moschino collection that came out a couple years ago. Like, there are a lot of surreal things that are very reminiscent of things that already exist, which, no shade, like, who would think to use that imagery like this?
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the world of backrooms comes from the mind of Cain Parsons, but a lot of other people on the internet who, again, I assume are teenagers who don't know these references. Or maybe they've seen them briefly and interpreted them.
Totally. And visually, this would blow your mind if you've never been to a museum, you know? Truly.
No, you are correct. I'm
like, if you've never seen like how an artist could take a familiar domestic object like a chair and make changes to it so it is no longer functional, like, this movie will blow your mind.
I guess if you're a teen seeing this film, which I think there were a few in our audience, because there's one scene, and I don't think I'm spoiling it because you see it in the trailer, of like a Christmas tree. I don't know if you remember this. There were like some kids who were like, oh, shit. And I'm like, okay, so this is clearly a reference to something.
Oh, the Christmas part was the best. I was like, is Nadia Lee Cohen and Kim Kardashian about to do another Santa baby situation? It looked really cool. And to your point about the Blair Witch Project, also the use of VHS or a VHS effect, as we later found out, was effective.
Well, yeah. I mean, just when you thought the found footage genre was dead, this completely reinvents it. Although it is funny to be looking at footage that is treated to look like old VHS footage from the 90s blown up on a, you know, however big the screen is.
Yeah. Look, it did look very cool.
It did. And I was researching how this film came to be because, as I said, the director is now 20 years old. He took his first meeting with A24 3 years ago. When he was 17, he was on the Zoom with A24 with his parents. And I was like, truly, how do you get from YouTube to an A24 film? And the answer is that Sean Levy, who is a film director, has a production company called 21 Laps. And his assistant at the time, named Lucas Ford, was tasked with going through and looking for interesting content creators on YouTube, on TikTok. And he found Cain Parsons. And Cain Parsons goes by the name Cain Pixels on YouTube. He amassed 3.3 million subscribers, over 300 million views for his 25-episode series about the backrooms that expands the lore. And he made all of this in a VFX program called Blender.
Extremely cool.
What's funny is he's anti-AI, which I think is very funny.
Well, isn't the film itself kind of about AI, or at least that's how I interpreted it?
Well, I know that they physically built all those sets. They built 30,000 square feet of sets where the cast and crew got lost on a daily basis.
I believe it. But interesting for a film that I perceived as criticizing AI and this sort of degraded versions of things that we end up seeing. It's interesting to me that, like I said, the backrooms themselves were so reminiscent of so many people's work.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw a take that was, you know, why so much horror that resonates with a younger generation is about the liminal space is because they grew up during the death of the mall and kind of the death of the corporate office. And so there's nothing scarier than that.
Right. And they also grew up watching POV style YouTube videos and playing Pokemon Go and shit like that.
We sound 100 years old.
No, but I do really think it does inform people's fears and a certain visual style that this movie clearly has.
I mean, as I've said, he's 20 years old, but it was spooky to see that he was born in 2005. We have filmmakers who were born after 9/11.
Hey, if they're good, I have no qualms about that. This does feel like a modern movie. Whether or not it's about AI, it has to be about the internet to some degree, no? Or like the algorithm or just the idea that you just keep going. Like the back rooms is almost just like a algorithm that just gradually degrades everything, you know?
Yes, even though the back rooms and the world takes place in the 90s. Yes, it's definitely a comment on the dead internet theory or the inshitification of the internet and of everything.
Totally. And also of human memory and how we remember things and how our memories evolve over time and stuff like that.
For sure. And of course, the back-to-back releases and success of Obsession and Backrooms has started this dialogue about, are the new filmmakers coming from YouTube?
They should be. They're already making movies.
Yeah, I think there's something to that in the way that, you know, film school was for the Spielbergs, Lucas, Coppolas, then it was the video store was to Tarantino and Kevin Smith and that Gen X slacker generation of filmmakers. This seems to be the new breeding ground for creators. And I think for the last 15 years, there's been a real struggle that traditional media has had with the internet. And I think the apex of which was the creation of Quibi. This idea of like, oh, we should take traditional media formats like television and movies and just break them down into 10-second clips. Where I think Curry Barker and Kane Parsons have proved that YouTube is its own format where you can do short form content, but people still desire film. That they have proved their talent in a short form, but there is a need to tell things in a long form format, and people still want to go to movies, even if they might get spit on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, also, I feel like we should mention those Australian YouTubers.
Oh, the guys that did Talk to Me.
Yes, the brothers that did Talk to Me and then did Bring Her Back. Those are some of the best horror movies of recent years that are completely born of YouTube.
It's a wild, wild world. As I love to say, podcasts are TV. YouTube is now movies.
But only horror movies? Like, where's the YouTube to rom-com pipeline?
You said it. I think because that's the realm of books still. Books to TV series to film romantic comedies.
Well, for a rom-com, I feel like that would require a woman or perhaps a young gay to start making rom-com, like short-form YouTube videos.
It's all possible. It's also funny that a lot of these YouTube horror directors are comedy guys. Or like, didn't the Talk to Me directors do YouTube stunts or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and there's definite humor in Backrooms also, while it is scary. Also, who was that clavicular-ass guy in Backrooms?
Oh, the assistant manager's boyfriend?
Yeah.
I don't know, but he was very hot and really made a strong point that men should be wearing crop tops.
Crop tops that say end apartheid, specifically.
That you then find in a pile of clothing.
By the pirate in the back rooms.
All right. Well, if we're in full spoiler territory, then you saw a Scary Movie, is it 6?
6, yes.
Which I did not. And we agreed that it's probably much more entertaining for you to tell me about Scary Movie 6 than us having both watched the film.
Okay, well, you didn't miss much. I'm not the biggest Scary Movie person. My wife loves those films, but I was curious what they would parody within the sort of modern A24 horror movie landscape.
Because horror films, since they last made a Scary Movie film, have become more prestigious.
But this movie did not speak to that at all, because it's still a parody of Scream. It's closer to a recent Scream movie than anything else. Obviously, there are moments within it where they're referencing other things, but they did not go into prestige horror at all, apart from Sinners.
Oh, that's interesting. No Hereditary references, no Get Out references.
Yeah, there was a Get Out thing, I believe, that turned into like a K-pop Demon Hunters parody, which actually was quite funny.
I mean, in Scary Movie's defense, there was another Scream film that came out earlier this year. So it's still in the zeitgeist.
Totally. But I would say it was mostly referencing Sinners, the TV show Wednesday, the most recent Halloween movie, like the Anna Faris character just became Jamie Lee Curtis, like in her crazy, like,
gray wig and
her bunker, her booby trapped house. Yeah, which was funny. Like, that's the perfect thing to do with that character. Sherry O'Terry was still Gale Weathers.
Oh, right. Is there still the Dewey?
Yes. Dewey was there. This movie was politically incorrect as ever, because if you'll remember, in the first Scary Movie, I believe the crime was committed by a parody of Deputy Dewey, who is portrayed as severely developmentally disabled.
Right. They do a Usual Suspects thing where all of a sudden he's sleek and suave and gets into a car at the end of the film.
Yeah.
That's pulling at the recesses of teenage Lauren's mind.
Totally. But apparently the best part was a parody of The Substance, which involved Sherry O'Terry, which I did not see because I went to the fucking bar at AMC, which, as you know, takes forever, and missed that entire part of the movie.
I won't lie. I did see a clip of something from Scary Movie 6 from someone's phone that was recorded in the theater. And I think there's a White Chicks reference within that Substance sequence as well. I didn't know until I started watching clips of Sean and Marlon Wayans doing press for this that people are clamoring for a White Chicks 2, but I've never seen White Chicks 1, so.
White Chicks 1 has its moments. It does have a fun fashion show sequence, as I remember, but not for me.
All right, so were those the best moments of Scary Movie 6?
Yes, I would say one thing that Scary Movie 6 did offer was great commentary on the tension between legacy characters in horror franchises and the new cast. And ultimately, the legacy characters were like, fuck these new characters, who cares if they live or die? Which I thought was a funny subversion.
Right.
But that was the only aspect of this movie to me that like really hit the nail on the head in terms of satirizing modern horror or whatever.
Well, now between Obsession and Backrooms, there are plenty of things for them to parody in Scary Movie 7. Maybe that's when they'll touch upon prestige horror.
Yeah. Anyway, enough horror movies for one week.
All right, guys, we will be back next week with a Sex and the City rewatch episode. What episode will we be doing? We don't even know.
Thank you for listening, as always.
Oh, and if you've been wondering why we haven't touched upon Gwyneth Paltrow's recent reveal of her political affiliation, the Los Angeles mayoral race, or the Michael Jackson documentary and film, it's because we deem those topics too hot for main feed. So we will be doing a special VIP episode that will be out early next week about such topics.
Until then.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Bye.